Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the latest in this OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Energy Transition Research Initiative at OIES. And just to date stamp this podcast, we're recording it on October the 26th, 2021, ahead of the COP26 meeting in Glasgow next week. My guest today is Malcolm Key, a senior research fellow at OIES, and we'll be discussing his article, COP26, This Time It's Serious, which was published 3 weeks ago in the latest edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which you can download for free from the OIES website. Malcolm, good morning and welcome to the podcast.
Good morning to the listeners.
Malcolm, your article has two main sections, one which reviews progress since COP21 in Paris in 2015, and one which looks at the key challenges which governments, policymakers, energy producers and consumers face as they meet in Glasgow, and more importantly, as they look to implement any agreements that are reached. Why don't we start with a bit of historical context? Can you first of all give us an overview of the Paris Agreement and explain its relevance to COP26?
Yeah, in fact, could I wind back even further? Many of our listeners may remember the Kyoto Protocol, which was the first big climate change agreement. That was based very much on a top-down approach, setting targets for countries, having sanctions if they failed to meet them. The problem is it really didn't work very well. Firstly, because, I mean, deliberately as part of the exercise, there weren't targets for developing countries. And secondly, because the US, because of that lack of targets for developing countries, didn't ratify. So the world's biggest emitter and the world's fastest growing emitter, China, were not included with targets in Kyoto. And of those who were included, the sanctions didn't work. Canada, for instance, saw it was going to miss its targets and simply withdrew from the protocol. So after quite a time, the Paris Agreement was set up on a completely different basis, a voluntary basis. It was up to individual countries to set their own targets and decide and monitor themselves and decide what they were going to do. It sounds like an invitation to freeloaders, but there were three big framework elements which were supposed to keep people's nose to the grindstone. The first was there was a big overall target, which was to keep anthropogenic global warming well below 2 degrees and preferably to 1.5 degrees centigrade. Secondly, there was a lot of transparency. People were supposed to put in their voluntary targets known as nationally defined contributions, that is, contributions to meeting the wider target. And these would be reviewed and discussed and then ratcheted up in successive meetings of the Conference of Parties. COP26 is significant from that point of view because it's the first big test. The third item to keep the whole thing together was a promise of cash, a lot of cash from developed countries to developing countries, 100 billion a year in the early 2020s. So these three elements were supposed to ensure that despite the voluntary approach, there was enough structure in the approach to keep the show on the road, as it were. Now, COP26 is the first big test of that idea. So it's very important. If the world can't work on the basis of a top-down approach, can it work on the basis of a bottom-up approach? And COP26 will very much demonstrate whether that's possible. The Paris Agreement was certainly a good proof of concept, but the commitments entered into there were nothing like enough to get us to 2 or 1.5 degrees centigrade.
How much would you say progress has been made since COP26, and you know how much progress we'll be discussing at COP26? And we've seen a lot of net zero targets being set. How important are they?
Well, a lot of progress has been made, and the net zero targets are part of it. At the time of the Paris Agreement, I don't think anyone was committing to net zero. But what happened after the Paris Agreement in 2018 was that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, published a report on how you would get to 1.5 degrees, and that set net zero by 2050 as the core target for everyone to aim at. Now, since then, you've had most large countries agreeing to a net zero target or proposing their own net zero target of one sort or another. They're very varied. Some are stronger than others. But the fact is that most countries have got those targets now. So that's considerable progress. But you've also seen a lot of progress on the ground. For instance, car companies with real commitments to electric vehicles. We've seen a lot of growth of interest, for instance, in hydrogen, which wasn't there in 2015. So I think you can say that an awful lot of the climate of opinion in industry is moving that way. And similarly, in the investment community, where investors are now putting strong pressure on energy companies to have decent climate targets. The courts are, for instance, we've seen that with Shell. Investment money is now committed itself to some sort of net zero target. So I think there's been a lot of progress. Whether it's enough is another matter, but there's been a lot of progress since Paris.
In terms of the COP26 as we approach it, obviously it's being held in Glasgow. The UK government holds the presidency. What are the UK government aspirations for the meeting? And perhaps you'd give us an overview of that.
It's got some very high level political targets first. And the first one, I think, is to establish itself as a global leader on climate change. The British government thinks it already is. It's had the biggest reduction in emissions since 1990 of any major economy. It's got the tightest target regime, for instance, a 68% reduction by 2030 compared with the EU's 55%. It's got the largest offshore fleet of wind farms in the world. Things like that. It does think already it's the world leader in climate change and doesn't feel it gets enough credit for it. So it wants a successful COP to establish that. It also wants to show that post-Brexit, it's still, you know, global Britain, it still matters in the world, it can still convene parties to a negotiation and bring it to a successful conclusion. So at a very high level, it's got some important political objectives. As far as the negotiations are concerned, its main objective, again, rather a high level, is to keep the 1.5 degrees and net zero by 2050 as the focus of the whole thing. It doesn't necessarily mean everyone's going to agree to that as such, but it wants to keep that as the centerpiece of the climate negotiations. Getting a little bit more specifically, what Boris Johnson has said is that he has four main target areas, which are cars, coal, cash, and trees. Now, the cars and coal part of it sort of reflect some British targets that are there already. The UK has said that by 2030, it won't allow the sale of internal combustion engine vehicles. I think it would like all countries to come up with some similar sort of a target. We're not talking about everyone agreeing to that target, but to a target or to an objective of phasing out internal combustion engine vehicles well before 2050. With coal, the UK has a target of removing it from power generation by 2025. Again, you can't expect every country to agree to that, but I think the UK would like some movement from everyone, which implies they all accept that coal is being phased out. Now, obviously, for countries like China and Australia, that's going to be difficult, and they certainly won't do it by 2024. But I think the UK government hopes for some sort of a statement on that. And inevitably, if they are, as both countries are, committed to net zero, they're going to have to get out of coal. So I think it would like a statement to that effect. We've already seen China, for instance, saying it will no longer finance coal plants overseas. So there are a number of moves in that direction. And that's the coals and cars part of it. On cash, we may be coming back to that later, but that's making sure this $100 billion, which has been promised by the rich countries, actually gets delivered, and that there is some commitment to ongoing cash after that first sort of promise, as it were, as and when it's met. Trees is not an energy issue as such, but I think they would also like some sort of a statement on stopping deforestation and planting new trees.
Okay, just briefly before we get on to the kind of challenges post-COP, what do you think the main outcomes of the meeting are likely to be? Do you see the prospects for a successful meeting, or are you worried about the potential for a breakdown?
I suspect it'll be halfway in between. I mean, it's difficult to forecast, as the Prime Minister said, it's a bit touch and go. But I think on the main objectives, since most major economies have now committed to net zero in some form or another, I think they can say they will, at the end of it, have successfully kept that target there in some form. On the sub-targets I've mentioned, it's likely there'll be something, not necessarily everything that the government would want. But I think, in a way, the main task at the moment is to keep the momentum going. The whole Paris Agreement arrangements are really a process, not just a set of single events. The main thing is that the process continues, that the momentum increases, and that the, you know, there is room for further reductions, because there are a number of further meetings further down the line. So I think there's a pretty good chance that the show will still be on the road after Glasgow, even if I don't expect that Glasgow will come up with, as it were, the solution. We won't be able to come out of Glasgow and say, OK, we are now on target for a 1.5 degree world. It won't all be there, but I think the aspiration may still be, in some sense, alive.
OK, great. Well, I mean, the other part of your article looks at the challenges following the COP. And I presume that, you know, implementation of the plans that are outlined at the meeting will be the main issue at stake. Can you just highlight what your main thoughts are on that?
I think the main problem is a number of governments, including, I think, the UK government, perhaps, have been treating it so far as simply a matter of taking one set of sources, fossil sources, and replacing them with another set of sources, low carbon sources. But it's much, much more than that. It means changing the whole way you approach and plan and operate, and the whole dynamics of the energy system. So far, the impacts have been mainly on electricity with the introduction of renewable sources. But with all these net zero commitments, momentum is going to have to spread to all other energy sectors, transport, industry, heating, and so on. And it will upturn them in the same way that it already has with electricity. I think many governments haven't realized the magnitude of the changes that are going to have to take place. And they're just thinking, well, it's just a case of, you know, promoting, say, renewable sources here, electric vehicles there, heat pumps there, and that'll solve the problem. It's not as simple as that.
I mean, indeed, you talk in your article about the kind of restructuring of the entire energy system. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you see the different fuels and energy sources interacting?
Well, if I could start with electricity, we've already gone quite a long way down the line on that. Because renewables have very different economic and operating characteristics from fossil sources, we're having to change just about everything about electricity. It's a slightly chaotic development at the moment. In most European countries, and particularly in the UK at the moment, the government, for instance, is effectively deciding on all investment. Looking forward, we know we're going to get problems in balancing the system and so on. And this all comes, as I say, of just assuming you can stick in a lot of renewables and assuming everything else remains the same. In the future, the problems are going to be on a much larger scale because they will extend across the energy system. In other parts of the energy system, you're going to have either electricity or hydrogen or carbon capture in some form, providing the energy sources. And those are all network industries, and they will require the planning, the coordination, the development of, well, one, two, or three new networks, depending on what approach governments go for. And that's inevitably quite a long-term arrangement. And they will need some system, a policy system or a market system, for ensuring they build the right networks in the right places at the right time, and in time to meet their net zero targets. So it's quite a major challenge.
And you also talk about energy efficiency and the need for kind of all consumers to really rethink the way they interact with the energy economy. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not actually exactly about energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is quite a minor part of the demand side changes that need to be made. If you think about it, net zero, you're not going to get there via energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is just about reducing amounts of energy. The new energy system will mean changing all the sources of energy, not just using less. And that will give all these system dynamic changes I've been talking about. And that will require consumers to have a new relationship with the industry. Probably an awful lot of this will be about much greater flexibility in when you use fuels, how you respond to price signals, what choices you make as between fuels, and so on. Energy efficiency will always be an important part of energy policy, but it's not the measure that's going to deliver a decarbonized new energy system on its own. And I think it's a bit of a distraction to think of demand side policy as being just about energy efficiency. It's not, it's about everything else and the whole different relationship that consumers have with their services. You can see it already to some extent in transport, where you have to think differently when you have an electric vehicle in terms of charging it up, and you know how you plan for traveling a distance and so on. It's about changing the way you think about your energy provision. If people change to, say, heat pumps in the domestic sense, that requires, again, differences in the sort of way heat is delivered to them and how they will have to use it. There are a lot of changes like that which consumers will have to make. So it's not just changes needed on the supply side. There are a lot of demand side developments that will be needed too.
So just moving on, you know, you talk about the need for government decisions in your paper in three key areas, which are infrastructure, coordination, optimization, and finance. So perhaps we could touch on those individually. You've already kind of mentioned infrastructure, and there's been a lot of talk about, in the gas sector particularly, about the need, potential need for a hydrogen infrastructure, sector coupling, power to gas. Can you go into a little bit more detail on how you see the challenges for infrastructure?
Yes, I think the problems in this area is that, at least for most developed countries, these are problems they haven't really had to tackle for many years. They've had their electricity infrastructure and their gas infrastructure already developed, and liberalisation was introduced after the development of these pieces of infrastructure. And by and large, in I think all developed countries, the infrastructure was developed under a monopoly or some form of monopoly regime. And it was easy to finance and easy to arrange on that basis. If governments are going to remain committed to liberalized markets, they're going to have to find some way of building this new infrastructure for perhaps hydrogen, perhaps carbon capture, perhaps a lot more electricity infrastructure in a different sort of climate. And they're going to have to come up with ways of doing this, as I say, in ways which are efficient and optimize the system as a whole. At the moment, there's nothing within the energy system which really tries to optimize as between different fuels. In the UK, for instance, and in most European countries, in fact, the costs of renewables and electricity, which, as I say, have been the main measures taken so far, are internalized from the electricity price. So the electricity price goes up. But if you're going to want people to switch to electricity, that doesn't make any sense. The UK government, buried in its latest strategy, the Net Zero Review, is talking in very cagey terms about switching that cost from electricity to gas to make it fair. But of course, in the current climate of high gas prices, that's not something they're likely to do. And in fact, they've been talking about the reverse, about possibly reducing VAT on gas. So it's a bit absurd. What you have is effectively a gas price which is subsidized in the sense that it pays a lower rate of VAT and then standard rate of VAT, an electricity price which is highly taxed, yet you want electricity to take over a much larger share of the energy market. It's got to find some way of getting around these problems and of developing the right sort of infrastructure. At the moment, say you have hydrogen, what's the best use of that hydrogen? Is it in electricity generation and storage? Is it in heating? Is it in industrial use? There are many possible competitors for this, and there's no clear way, given that the hydrogen is not going to be directly economic in any of these uses, for directing it to the most efficient use.
I mean, so you've touched on coordination and optimization there. I mean, the other issue you raise in your article is that governments also need to come clean about the sort of the costs that are going to be implicit in the transition, particularly in the short to medium term. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, in the long run, it's quite possible there won't be any net cost, and some studies have come out recently saying it could be cheaper in the long run. But in the short run, there is a huge, an absolutely huge investment requirement. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, reckons it is about $4 trillion a year. And we're a long way away from that. And B, it's going to be very difficult for developing countries to fund that sort of requirement by themselves. Now, we're already, as I mentioned earlier, having a difficulty in meeting the 100 billion, which is supposed to be being provided by the rich countries to developing countries to help them with their climate plans. That probably won't be met in 2020 as it was supposed to be, not till about 2023 or so. But this is a requirement that's going on almost, you know, for decades after that, according to the IEA. And if you may think $100 billion is a lot of money, but compared with the IEA's $4 trillion, it's really quite a small amount of money. So I would expect one of the big issues for COP26 would be to ensure that that money is provided and that more is provided after the immediate promise of $100 billion. Meanwhile, the developed countries, indeed all countries, will have the problem of attracting money for all these investments. And it's not clear that they know how to do it within a liberalized regime, given that, as I say, the infrastructure developments under previous regimes have been done under monopoly conditions of one sort or another, which is much easier to finance. They will, apart from anything else, there will need to be a clear long-term policy and a clear strategy which people can fund if they're going to get the necessary money coming forwards. And the difficulty is that the most government policies tend at the moment not to be clear long-term strategies, but piecemeal interventions. So you have the growth of renewables, and then a lot of countries deciding, well, we have to have capacity markets in order to offset the intermittency of renewables. And so you have essentially piecemeal reactive interventions rather than a clear long-term strategy in many cases.
Okay, well, I mean, as we get to the end of this podcast, I'm going to ask you about your kind of conclusions for COP26 and beyond. I mean, you mentioned in your article a number of reports that have come out which suggest that if we get this right and we get the balance right, then we know this can be a not only an environmentally friendly, but actually an economically rational long-term solution. But you've highlighted a number of short-term challenges. So what do you think about the prospects that governments and policymakers will actually come to some reasonably successful outcomes at COP26? And what do you think the key milestones are that we should look out for over the next few years to see if we are actually on track with implementation?
I think there's a reasonable chance of a half successful outcome to COP26, as I mentioned, but it won't be enough to reach the 1.5 degree target. So on that front, I would hope for increasing moves. If you have the sort of statements I've mentioned about moving out of coal, moving out of internal combustion engine vehicles, I think that will in turn have an impact on the investment market and on industry, and we'll see more movement at that level. So I would expect to see on the ground the same sort of changes as we've seen since the Paris Agreement, and I would hope at an accelerating pace. What's much more difficult to see is whether governments will pick up the policy challenge I've mentioned and actually come up with a means of deciding this. In the UK, for instance, the government on hydrogen has said basically that it won't reach a decision until 2026 on whether hydrogen is going to be there's going to be hydrogen infrastructure across the UK or not. And that creates big problems, I think, because 2026 is getting fairly close to 2050 in the sense that building a whole new national infrastructure is going to mean there's not an awful lot of time for that. And the difficulty is, meanwhile, if the government says, for instance, for new developments, there's no, they don't want the use of gas from 2025, it means that people are going to start off going down one route, that is the electricity heat pump route, which may indeed be the best route in the long run, but it won't be until after they've started going down that road that the government will even decide whether it's the right road to go down. And I think that creates problems. If the government decides in 2026 that it wants a hydrogen system, and then it's more or less said that by 2035 it will stop any new gas boilers, there really has to be some alternative in place by then, whether it's heat pumps or a hydrogen pipeline system or something else. And it's not clear they're going to meet that target unless they start thinking of the overall strategy in a more coherent way, rather more quickly.
Okay, so thank you very much indeed, Malcolm. We've come to the end of our time now. So thanks very much for your fascinating insights ahead of obviously what's going to be a very important 2 weeks in Glasgow. And then, as you've mentioned, the key questions around implementation and policy thereafter. I just repeat that you can find Malcolm's article and 17 others from eminent authors in the latest edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is entitled COP26, Examining the Balance Between Ambitious Pledges and Realistic Expectations. You can download it from the website at www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find other papers and podcasts from our new Energy Transition Research Initiative. I hope that you'll find them useful, and do contact us if you'd like any more information. With that, thank you for listening, stay healthy, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.